to think about something of particular interest to you and also to improve your writing and research skills. It's not a lot of fun for the TAs or for me to go through these different stages of a prospectus and a rough draft. In fact, it's a great deal of work. But I am of the strong conviction that many of you are really cheated in your high school education and college education because faculty don't take enough time to correct your writing. And it's very disturbing to me that many of you, even as Cornell seniors, cannot write effectively. And thus we do take really quite a bit of time working with you on organization, grammar, even very pedantic things like punctuation and all the rest. But the main purpose of the paper is to give you an opportunity to do something that would really make sense to you and that you would enjoy. I don't think university education should be all drudgery. And this means that you really can tie in with the course at a great many different points. If you're most interested in some aspect of ethical theory or what we talk about when we talk about character, you may do something of a more philosophical or theological bent. If you're more interested, for instance, in some of the readings like Thomas Merton or Reinhold Niebuhr, you may do something of a more biblical or religious bent. Some students over the years, for instance, who've come out of a Jewish background but had lost touch with their heritage have found it really quite exciting to do a term paper on some aspect of Jewish scriptures or some aspect of Talmud or Judaism. The same with Christian students and others. Some of you may want to focus more on some particular environmental issue, how we handle conflict situations and situations, for instance, such as the Exxon Valdez disaster or the Alar scare of a number of years ago, or how we balance the interests of individuals as over against larger groups. The one requirement that is rather firm is that since this is a humanities course, you may not write on a science or environmental subject in a purely technical, engineering, scientific manner. If you deal with an environmental issue, and I hope many or most of you will do that, you need to bring in some normative, ethical, moral dimensions of the problem. If you were to write, for instance, on a question like animal welfare, there it would be very hard to avoid the moral and philosophical issues. But I could see you writing on an issue such as, let's say, the Exxon Valdez disaster, where you did it in a purely technical sense, just looked at some of the costs, some of the cleanup methods that were used, and some of the things that might have prevented this from happening again. And that would not be adequate. I want you, if you take an environmental issue, to bring in those moral, normative, philosophical dimensions. And there are a lot of ways that this can be done, and that's where the TAs and I will help you with it. Most students over the years have really found the term papers very interesting to do and have really enjoyed them, and sometimes years later have said that what they learned through doing the term paper was one of the best parts of their Cornell experience. So I do want you to enjoy this experience. Jim, do you want to add any words? You mean later in the week? Why don't we talk about that and we'll discuss? We'll announce it on Thursday. That would probably, then we can do it either way. Good. Okay. Does anyone have a question on the paper? You can see me later or the TAs if you do, but I think you'll find it a good part of the course. I want to spend just a little time this morning on some definitions, some of which we have touched on in passing and some of which the assigned readings have touched on, but I thought that it might be good to develop these a little further and also to offer something of a review. First, some of the different ways of talking about ethics. You recall in the first or second lecture, I just very briefly hinted at this, but we can do ethics in a purely descriptive mode. That is, we can do the kind of thing that an anthropologist or sociologist or historian does. We can describe and analyze the various moral or ethical beliefs which different cultures have. Whether it's a larger cultural conglomeration such as Europe or a particular country such as Canada or perhaps even a very tiny tribal culture somewhere in the Philippines or wherever. We can describe, interpret, try to make clear how morality functions in the life of this people, what particular moral beliefs they hold, what are some of the differences between what we might think of as taboos and other types of moral commitments. And this makes no judgments about the rightness or wrongness of any of these moral beliefs. It's simply attempting to describe. And this is a very widespread way of approaching ethics. It would be the typical way that anthropologists or sociologists or historians would deal with ethics. Normative ethics rather deals with the question, is this right or wrong? Is this good or bad? Is this way of acting better morally than another way? Is it right always to tell the truth? Or are there some cases where one is excused from the ordinary requirement of telling the truth? What about issues of how races relate to each other or how male and female relate to each other? How about questions like euthanasia and abortion and so on? What is the right way or the good way to act in these situations? Normative ethical statements would be things like one ought always to tell the truth, or the good person does not cheat or steal, or it is always wrong to harm someone. And as you can see from that last statement, these may be debatable because there are situations like wartime where we do harm individuals, and yet many, perhaps most people feel they believe that under particular circumstances, that may be the best way to act morally. One can refer to an entire system of normative ethics as, for instance, Christian or Jewish or Marxist ethics. Countless articles and books have been written elucidating various systems of ethics. Most philosophers would insist that normative ethics must present, or at least be willing to present, reasons for particular ethical judgments. Although I should add immediately that this issue is complex, and others would insist that one's basic ethical judgments are not based on reason, at least in a technical or instrumental sense, but on something like intuition or revelation, or what Aristotle called phronesis, practical reason. Now, meta-ethics is the study of what is going on when we make a moral judgment. A fair part of what we have done so far in the course could be called meta-ethics. That is, we've asked, is a moral claim, does it have any knowledge content? Can we have any confidence in the correctness of a moral claim? Or are we just expressing personal feelings or personal preferences? Think of Alan Wood's article on relativism. He wasn't trying to tell us what was right or wrong in a particular case. He was discussing the very nature of moral or ethical claims and was taking the position in this piece that radical relativism or radical subjectivism is not a coherent position. That to say this may be right for me, but wrong for you under identical circumstances, this may be good for me, but bad for you, in a moral sense, not in a non-moral sense of tastes and so on, that, Wood says, is ultimately incoherent. We cannot make sense out of that kind of claim. Can one talk meaningfully or rationally about moral claims, or are such claims simply expressions of feeling and personal taste? A position that I think many in today's world hold, a position of radical relativism. It was the position of the logical positivists. Recall that their major principle, the verification principle, was that one ought not to accept as true anything that cannot be verified empirically. What cannot be verified empirically or with sense data is neither true nor false. It is nonsense. It just is not cognitively coherent or meaningful. And you'll recall as we talked briefly about the logical positivists and as Barber talked about them, he pointed out that the odd thing about such a position is that the verification principle does not survive its own test. That is, it itself is not based on empirical data. You can't show sense data or empirical data to show the truth of the verification principle. And if it cannot survive that test, why should we believe it as true unless it's simply some kind of a definition? And if it's an arbitrary definition, why this rather than some other? And that's one of the problems that anyone has who tries to make that kind of an ultimate statement of incoherence or of relativity, that those kinds of claims usually sabotage themselves because the claim itself stands under the same judgment. Now, as we begin to talk about different ethical theories in a more organized way, different ways of thinking about and analyzing particular situations, I believe we ought to keep in mind several important considerations. The first is that even though we spend most of our time in ethics talking about the difficult cases, including discussion of issues about which different individuals and different schools of thought and different cultures may disagree, the empirical reality is that we agree on a very great number of moral truths. We often overlook this, the fact that it is the disagreements that attract our attention. Tough issues like abortion and euthanasia and so on, but we actually agree on a very large number of moral considerations, not just in our own culture, but cross-culturally. And I've touched on some of this before. Who do you know who seriously wants to argue for the moral acceptability or correctness of murder, rape, gross dishonesty, torture, cruelty to children, poisoning someone's water supply, gossiping about one's friends, loyalty to one's closest friends, bearing false witness against one's neighbor, and one could go on and on. This is where Booth is particularly helpful. Most of us don't really doubt the moral veracity of those claims. We only pretend to because we have been taught that all moral judgments are relative. But in each of these cases, try to think of even a single good reason why you would doubt some of these basic claims. It's very easy to see that if we had a society in which inflicting indiscriminate harm on other people was permitted, as I've indicated before, that society would not long survive. or if it was a lesser form of harm, it would be a mean and unpleasant society in which to live. So we have to keep in mind, I think, when we do ethics, that there is a large area of agreement culturally and even cross-culturally, but typically we do not talk about that agreement. That's why I think that many courses in ethics at the college level and even in high school sometimes give the wrong impression, because they focus on moral dilemmas or the difficult cases, and students very easily come away with the impression that everything in morality is up for grabs. But that simply is not the case, and clearly that is not the way we would think about chemistry or physics or mathematics. There are borderline cases, tough questions, unsolved riddles and mysteries in each of these areas, but you don't take the beginning student and start at that point. You start with the fairly simple stuff upon which there's agreement. And then if the student reaches an advanced stage, she may grapple with some of these tougher issues. Now, in the second place, it's very important to remember that human beings throughout the ages have led good lives, more or less, in spite of the fact that few have ever formally studied ethics. Indeed, one could make a good case that many people have been corrupted by bad ethical theory. I think you could make a strong case that some aspects of Marxist ethical theory have been very corrupting. The position, for instance, that the end justifies the means, that one can betray even friends and family for the sake of a good end, I think has been exceedingly corrupting. I think there have been ethical theories associated with different religions, with Christianity and Islam and others, that have overall had a very negative effect on the social fabric. Not always because the moral reflection itself was bad, but because the empirical observations upon which the moral reflection reflected, that it was inaccurate. A good deal of racism, for instance, was not because moral theory was bad, but because people made wrong judgments about who blacks or orientals or others were. They had beliefs about superiority and inferiority, and in terms of those beliefs, the moral judgments made some sense, but of course, those empirical judgments were wrong. That tends to be also the case, I think, about a very tough issue like abortion. Most of the conflict in the abortion issue is not a moral conflict. It's a worldview philosophical conflict that has to do with the status of the baby and or fetus. Notice the terminology itself judges or prejudges the outcome. So that if this truly is a human being, and even more so if it's a human being that we would think of in some sense as a person, it seems to me the abortion issue is fairly easy to resolve. That is, it would seem rather preposterous morally that for the convenience of the family or the woman or the husband and wife, you could abort this child, killing a human being in a person. But of course, if this is not a human being in the full sense, and clearly not a person, then the abortion issue looks very different. So that it's not that this side and this side has very different moral judgments about this particular issue. It's that their larger worldview takes different positions on the status of the baby or fetus. And that is true of a good deal of moral conflict. And that's why in areas such as race relations, relations between the sexes and so on, changes in scientific understanding, changes in what we understand the world to be like, have a great impact on moral outcomes. And that's where you'll see in this week's reading where Stanley Hauerwas draws heavily on Iris Murdoch, and her claim that ethics is not so much a matter of choice or decision as vision. How do you see the world? What is the world like? I think that claim makes a great deal of sense. Sometimes it makes all the difference how you see things. Now, thirdly, ethical theory largely builds on the moral beliefs and practices that actually prevail in various cultures. Just like the scientist observes and studies the world about him, so the moralist observes, studies, and tries to clarify and bring greater consistency to the moral beliefs and practices we already adhere to. The philosopher John Rawls refers to a method of reflective equilibrium, where you take your considered moral judgments across a spectrum and try to bring them into a more consistent equilibrium. We find that sometimes we believe things morally that are quite contradictory, and that produces a kind of cognitive or epistemological tension. And in general, there may be paradoxical situations where this does not altogether hold, and we do have statements such as that consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds and so on. But in general, we find it better to be consistent and to have a kind of equilibrium among our various moral beliefs than to lack those. And this is a reflective equilibrium. It's not one you just decide on a Sunday afternoon because there's nothing better to do. It's part of the whole process of what it means to be a human being. And it's one of the reasons, I believe, why we talk so much. We are the animals that chatter all the time, probably a good deal more even than the primates, the higher apes. We talk so much because a great deal of our talking and our storytelling and our arguing has to do in one respect or another, some of it doesn't, but a great deal does, with how we ought to live. What does the good life look like? What does the good society look like? We're in the midst of a tremendous national debate right now over medical care. And that, in part, is a moral debate having to do with justice and concern for the poor and having to do with a great variety of issues that we spend a lot of time talking about because that's part of what it means to be human beings. Now, in the fourth place, I would argue, and this is a point which I've made already in an earlier lecture, that there is a certain messiness to human existence, and that to be too zealous to try to clean up everything and to change every human being into some model of perfection, to want to do that tomorrow, if not today or yesterday, that this will probably, in the long run, do more damage than good. I've already quoted Victor Firkus's comment on Teilhard de Chardin, the Roman Catholic philosopher and naturalist, scientist. And Victor Firkus complained of Teilhard. He complained of Teilhard's impatience with the messiness of ordinary human life. The mark of the true totalitarian is impatience with the messiness of ordinary human life. The mark of the true totalitarian. And the older I get, the more I realize that even some very good people, people who honestly, deeply seek for justice, if they're in too much of a hurry, if they too much want to clean up everything and not have any messiness at all, they're probably going to be people who will harm us a great deal. I think this is quite obvious, as I suggested before, in the case of Marxism. I think you can see this kind of obsessive quality in the young Adolf Hitler. He used to see bits of garbage or trash on the streets, and he would go into an utter rage that things were out of place. There was a tremendous obsessive quality. He so passionately wanted to have everything just right. And it seems to me that in ethics, as in life in general, there needs to be a certain tolerance of messiness. I think of Jesus' parable of the wheat and the tares. He tells the disciples they shouldn't be too zealous to pull the weeds out of the wheat field, because in pulling them out, they'll pull the wheat out too, and the end result will be worse than if they had done nothing. In the fifth place, we should be very clear about the fact that widespread disagreement among different ethicists about what is the best theoretical framework for talking about and understanding moral theory, moral reality, should not be interpreted to signify that we are totally confused about the validity of the great majority of ethical principles by which most ordinary people live. Now, I'm not saying that these disagreements among the theorists are unimportant, but rather how we live out our lives, for the most part, does not depend on their resolution. The fact that we don't fully understand, for instance, how digestion works does not mean that we stop eating. The fact that we don't understand in any detail the physical principles of how to ride a bicycle doesn't mean that we never ride a bicycle. We cannot articulate accurately how we swim, ride a bicycle, walk, recognize human faces, and so on. But we are able to make sense out of our ordinary human experience because we know we can do this. We don't need to be able to say how, we just know that it works. And to a certain degree, that's also true in the realm of ethics. Don't get hung up on the fact that the utilitarians and the rights-oriented theorists, we'll talk about them in a minute, that they're in radical disagreement. Those disagreements are important, but they're not dispositive. They're not final. They don't cut us off from the good life. And I think that's, again, one of the dangers of courses in ethics. Now, in the sixth place, and I've already touched on this lightly before, in thinking about matters of applied ethics, we should always distinguish between theoretical and practical questions. In purely theoretical inquiries, we are not under pressure to make decisions, to actually commit ourselves to the best course of action. But in practical matters, we must decide, we must act, and often under a time constraint. One of the constant factors in warfare, take the invasion of North Africa or of Western Europe in World War II, particularly, let's say, if you were in a time when you were retreating from the enemy. Your army vehicle breaks down, and you have to constantly make these choices. Do I fix it right so that it'll last indefinitely, or with the shells coming closer, the enemy tanks appearing on the horizon, do I take a chance that it'll last maybe just for 20 minutes and get out of there as fast as I can? You don't have time to make the theoretically best decision in that case. You have to decide under tremendous time constraint, and if you make the wrong decision, or if you make no decision at all, you're dead. And much of life is like that. A great deal of life has this kind of time pressure. We're making decisions not under optimal conditions. We're sort of bumbling along, muddling through. We have a lot of expressions for this. And that's very, very important to keep in mind. And as a matter of fact, most of us are very good at that. Even though we can't answer some of the very fascinating theoretical questions were really very good at getting along in a practical way. I used the illustration a couple lectures ago of what you would do if your truck breaks down in the middle of the Sahara Desert. Or let's say it doesn't break down, let's say it's getting very wobbly and the wheels are shaking and the engine is sputtering. Normally, any sensible person would not abandon the truck under those conditions and start walking unless she had a better truck to get into and proceed. So that often in moral dilemmas, you may not be at all satisfied in a theoretical sense with the position you're taking, but unless you can find a better position available to you, you muddle along with what you have. And that's eminently rational and sensible, because you won't make out well at all without some plan of action. You abandon the inadequate truck in the middle of the Sahara and start walking and you're dead. Not a rational approach to take. You can think of all kinds of illustrations here, some of them a little bit ridiculous. As I look at my notes here, it almost sounds ridiculous, but I write, if a man and a woman are stranded on a South Pacific island with little chance of rescue, if either of them would like to have a friend, it doesn't make much sense to hold out for someone ideal. They had better learn to live with what they have. For the man to hold out for someone with the figure of Marilyn Monroe, the mind of Barbara McClintock, and the moral probity of Mother Teresa simply means that he will have no friend at all, and so on. Life is constrained by all kinds of practical situations, and that's the world in which we make ethical decisions. So don't abandon the moral standards you already have in place if you can think of none better. To be sure, we may not be absolutely certain about much in the realm of morality, just as we are not absolutely certain about much in science, but that doesn't mean that we do not know anything. Practical wisdom is over against theoretical wisdom, as Aristotle so well knew, demands that you live with whatever is the best available understanding to you at the time. We simply cannot put our lives into deep freeze while we wait for perfect understanding. You can think of countless examples. As I've indicated, you don't refuse to eat because you don't understand how digestion works, and so on. Now, at this point, really is more important than it may seem, because many of you have been taught that you ought to approach moral questions from the standpoint of doubt. That unless you can prove the truthfulness of this particular moral claim, you ought not to continue to adhere to it. And of course, on many of the more important issues and some of the really tough borderline questions, we cannot offer that kind of knockout proof. What I'm saying is that that is an irrational way to proceed. This is also what Booth is saying, and Barber, and Hauerwas, and others. That it is far more rational to hold on to what you have and muddle through with what you have, trying to improve it as you go, rather than to abandon that if nothing better is available. Now, also, one needs to add, of course, that sometimes something better does become available, and then it is rational to abandon your older position and to take a new position. Now, let me just very briefly point to a couple of the dominant theoretical ways of approaching ethics. Among philosophers, we have probably today three dominant types of ethical theory. In the first place, we have what we sometimes refer to as teleological theories. Telos, T-E-L-O-S, in Greek means end or teleios, T-E-L-E-I-O-S. Teleios means perfected. Sometimes teleological ethics are called aretaic ethics. A-R-E-T-A-I-C from the Greek word arete. And teleological ethics ask the question of what is good? What is a good end to work for? We think of utilitarians like Jeremy Bentham or John Stuart Mill, who talked about maximizing the good or the greatest good for the greatest number. Utilitarians have tended to see the good, for instance, in terms of happiness or in terms of pleasure. We ought to maximize the total amount of happiness. This theory or this approach to ethics is very widespread and very useful, I would say, in limited ways. I think that a teleological or utilitarian approach has a lot of usefulness in limited economic decisions, for instance. Other things being equal, as they often are not, it does make sense to do cost-benefit analyses if you do them honestly. Often things are not equal. Scenic beauty and the economic value of electric power are not always commensurate, and often cost-benefit analyses are not done very honestly, so we tend to be pretty negative about them. But within a limited range, cost-benefit analyses done well are very useful because, in general, it would seem that it's better for a society to be efficient than inefficient. If you're efficient, other things being equal, that is, if your efficiency does not build on injustice or raping the environment, your efficiency does provide more resources to do other things you want to do as a society, to allow people to improve their lives in other ways. The problem with teleological theories, or more specifically of a kind of cost-benefit analysis or utilitarian approach, is that often things are not commensurate. You cannot compare them because they're apples and oranges. They're different things. And also, because of the particular problem that we get as a kind of fallout of utilitarianism, that utilitarianism allows you to harm some people for the sake of the aggregate good. And that seems very, very problematic to us in various ways. In that respect, Marxism was a utilitarian theory for the sake of the common good, of bringing in the classless society, the new economic reality. You could take the lives of thousands and millions, even of your own citizens. And most of us would be very troubled by an ethical theory that permitted that kind of outcome. And that's why there are probably relatively few pure utilitarians. There are variations of utilitarianism, rule utilitarianism, and so on, that partly get around that particular problem. But still, in a limited way, I would say we're all utilitarians. In a limited way, if we're trying to solve a very specific problem, something wrong with the car, or how to build this bridge in the best way, we tend to think in those kinds of terms. If we had time, we would spend a good deal more on each of these theories, and I'm a little bit frustrated because we do not. Now, Alistair MacIntyre, in his book After Virtue, discussing utilitarianism, says, if someone suggests to us that we should guide our own choices by the prospects of our own future pleasure or happiness, the appropriate retort is to inquire, but which pleasure, which happiness ought to guide me? He refers to the polymorphous character of pleasure and of happiness. And of course, the same criticism is applicable if we try to apply the principle of utility on a societal scale, unless we are simply willing to let people vote on everything. And in that case, the ultimate principle would no longer be utility, but the democratic principle. In other words, to say that we ought to maximize the good or to maximize happiness is not that useful a principle unless you specify much more in detail which kind of happiness ought to be maximized as over against others, because there are many different kinds of good experiences and many different kinds of happiness. Perhaps even more lethal to the utilitarian principle is that our understanding of ourselves and of our society is often very limited. When you talk about using other people, treating them unjustly for the sake of maximizing the collective good, slavery is a kind of obvious example, I think what we have to face up to is not only the fact that this gets us into situations which just prima facie, just obviously seem wrong to us, but also that we simply are not smart enough to have any large-scale understanding of how things work out for the best in the end. We can't even do this in our individual lives, let alone in groups and in entire societies and on a global level. I can think of just one kind of personal experience that I think is illustrative. Back in 1973-74, I had decided that I had been at Earlham College long enough. I had been there about 12 years and liked it very much, and I was looking for some kind of a career change. And had a very, very interesting job offer at a kind of conference center where I would have spent about a third of my time in pure research and about a third of my time teaching and about a third of my time consulting with government and other agencies on environmental issues. I was very well into the whole area of environmental ethics at that time. And it looked like an extremely attractive job to me. But after an initial period where the director of this center was extremely cordial and just went out of his way to make everything look good in a way that was totally incomprehensible to me, he suddenly turned on me and started undermining the whole situation. I was at first just mystified. At first you doubt your own sanity, you know, what is this really happening? And he just began to spread rumors about me, say things that were untrue, and the whole thing fell through. I should add here that he did that then to two or three other people, and finally the board of directors realized that he was losing his grip, and he ended up with some very severe mental problems and had to be released from the job. But I was the first one where this had happened, and the board at that point didn't see the larger picture and thought that what he was saying about me was true. Well, it was because of that situation falling through that the opportunity opened up to come to Cornell, which was just the ideal place for me. I'd had offers at places like the University of California, Santa Cruz, but that was just a liberal arts setting, and to do environmental ethics optimally, you need an engineering college and an ag school and so on. And this suddenly opened up, and I would not have been free to accept this if it had not been for this irrational behavior on the part of the director. Now, that's an utterly common experience. We all have this kind of experience in our own lives. A boyfriend, a girlfriend, jilts you and you feel awful about it, but a month or two later when you meet someone much more wonderful, you see how great this was that this happened. Now, if we're not even able to make these kinds of calculations in our own lives with any reliability, how in the world do we think we can make these calculations about maximizing the good for society as a whole? And particularly if doing so requires us to act unjustly towards people in the short run. This is the stuff of novels, Crime and Punishment. Should Raskolnikov kill the old woman who's a wretched human being in many respects and take her money and use it to build hospitals or help the poor or whatever? Seems like a rational plan. And in a strictly utilitarian calculus, that would be a moral thing to do. But of course, most of us realize that that's an extraordinarily dangerous thing to do, and that life could become very grim indeed if we moved in that direction. Now, again, that's not to discredit utilitarianism altogether. I don't think it's an adequate framework in the larger sense. In micro situations, as I've indicated, we all are utilitarians to a certain degree. McIntyre, referring to the concept of the greatest good or happiness for the greatest number, he refers to this as a conceptual fiction. At the very least, I think we could say that its definition is always dependent on one's larger worldview. It is not a principle that can be utilized rationally or unproblematically without deciding at a more basic level what life is all about. There are various ways this impacts on environmental issues. We have terms like shadow pricing, trying to figure out what people would be willing to pay to preserve this wilderness area or to achieve this level of water purity and so on. And my experience is that although that kind of a methodology may give you some clues about an appropriate course of action, it's not overall particularly useful. Partly because in actual life, you don't make decisions of that sort one at a time. You make decisions as a kind of total package, and although you might indicate a willingness to pay quite a bit if deciding in isolation to preserve this or that environmental amenity, if you had to make a similar decision for hundreds and thousands of environmental amenities, you would probably quickly realize that you were in big trouble. And the method, I think, can't be used very fruitfully beyond giving us some very limited clues in particular situations. Now, as I've indicated, in defense of the utilitarians, they have themselves realized most of these problems and thus have developed alternative or modified approaches to utilitarianism, rule utilitarianism, and others, and it continues to be a reasonably important and active philosophical theory. Another problem that we face with the position is that in most forms of utilitarianism, only the total good is taken into account and not the distribution of the good. In most just arrangements, we cannot talk just about how much of a resource there is, but how is it distributed among various people who need it or who desire it, so that we deal with questions of distributive justice, not just with questions of maximizing the particular resource. I should add, just in closing, I'm going to have to go on to deontological and social contract theories on Thursday, but I should add that I'm very painfully aware of how ridiculous it is to touch on these large-scale theories in 20 or 30 minutes, such as we're doing here. Obviously, there are whole courses, not just on utilitarianism, but just on one particular figure, such as John Stuart Mill. But the nature of this course is not to give you in-depth understanding of these issues, but to give you a kind of overview that makes it possible then for you to continue thinking about these questions and reading on your own. We'll go on Thursday to the next two categories.